Good evening. This is session 5 of the Age of Crony Capitalism. We're going to talk tonight about the breakdown of fiscal discipline and military cronyism. So I thought that the music that I used to start the session be sort of appropriate. So, okay, fiscal breakdown. Can't talk about fiscal breakdown without talking about John Maynard Keynes. Okay, Keynes really gave the scientific cover to politicians all over the world that wanted to spend money without alerting their subjects that they were indeed the source of that money. Now, fiscal orthodoxy, traditionally, has meant a balancing budget. But interesting, even Franklin Roosevelt, after he was elected in 1932 and he started his administration, he actually initially pushed for the passage of what was called the 1933 Economy Act, which was supposed to cut federal spending by about $250 million, which was something in those days. I mean, not a great amount, but, you know, it was sort of a start. Right at the beginning of his administration, he wanted to cut salaries of federal workers and actually reduce benefit payments to veterans. Surprisingly, that didn't really go anywhere. And so even, you know, Roosevelt, at least at the beginning, was making a pretense of observing that taboo against government deficit. The only exception, the only time where it was considered acceptable, you know, to have a government deficit was when there was a war. There was a war, a matter of life and death, lose, you know, deficit's going to be the least problem that you've got. So that, you know, was like no holds barred. You could spend what you wanted even if you couldn't collect it in taxation. Again, Keynes put forth a theory that was taken as scientific, but saying to them, no, you know, what you always wanted to do but felt like you couldn't because it wasn't the right thing to do. No, there are a lot of circumstances in which it really is the right thing to do. Okay, so Keynes had a theory of aggregate demand management that really turned the traditional fiscal orthodoxy on its head. Now again, you know, a lot of problems with this aggregate demand theory of Keynes. You know, the biggest one in my view is that it basically ignores scarcity. It sort of denies the idea that government spending has an opportunity cost, right? You just, you know, you look at the very simple multiplier model, which sort of assumes a horizontal aggregate supply curve, you know, if you want to think of it in those terms. It's assuming that the demand creates its own supply. So if there's a demand for it, then the goods and services will be there. And again, you think about that longer than about 3 seconds, and it's sort of silly. Another thing that Keynes' aggregate demand theory does is it ignores the fact of time. We operate in time, and especially when you're thinking about, you know, how can you create aggregate demand, you know, by government spending, and how is saving, right? You know, why is there not enough aggregate demand in Keynes' view? A lot of times it's because people are saving too much. Well, the idea is that, well, if they're saving, people aren't spending money on goods and services, therefore the producers aren't going to produce those goods and services. But again, the whole idea of saving, you know, saving doesn't mean you don't want to consume at all. Saving means you don't want to consume now so that you can be able to consume in the future. Okay, if you didn't want to save, if you didn't want to consume at all now, you would work less. You would spend less time earning income, and then you wouldn't, you know, have, you know, as much to consume. But the fact that people do work more, but they save, they put aside some of what they earn in saving, means that they want to consume some of it now, but not all of it. They want to consume the rest at some time in the future. That's something that really goes against the grain of, Keynesian economics. And also, it doesn't really look at the supply side, right? Just government spending and investment spending, they do the same thing. They both increase aggregate demand by the same amount, even though presumably private investment demand creates capital goods that are going to increase the capacity of the economy to produce more goods and services in the future, whereas government spending, except only by the most fortunate of accidents, doesn't do that. And even Keynes, Keynes actually makes a little bit of recognition of this point. When he says that you know, two wars, two masses for the dead, two pyramids, you know, you are still spending and they still help the economy. He does then, you say, well, of course, it's better to use, you know, spend in productive ways rather than in unproductive ways. But again, that didn't seem to get through to a lot of his followers, certainly in the simplest forms of his theory. The idea there is the government spending is as good as any kind of spending. It creates demand, and you know, that'll solve many macroeconomic problems. You know, so the idea of, you know, good finance, you know, good public finance in Keynes' view, is not to always balance the budget, but to use fiscal stimulus to maintain full employment. See, that always trumps budget balancing. That breaks the taboo. Now, again, there's a little bit of where he says, well, but you can do this over the cycle, so you could have surpluses in the, you know, in the boom times and only use deficits, you know, to combat a slump. But again, we see how often that's actually been observed in practice over the past, I guess, 80 years almost, it is, since Keynes wrote the general theory. So that's, you know, the setting. So that, and his theories, again, didn't really hint by even Roosevelt, who can be construed in some ways as conducting a Keynesian policy, really, to the extent that he ran government deficits, was not because he understood and wanted to follow Keynes' ideas, but rather, he used it just as a way of buying votes. And indeed, FDR was a master at using the public fisc to buy votes. So he breaks that taboo. And you know, from that, I want to look at the U.S. federal debt, look at it historically, and just start out just talking a little bit about it. But one of the things that we'll see is the history of federal debt is the history of crisis. The crisis is the health of the state. You know, Randolph Bourne said war is the health of the state, and he was right. But what is war? Well, war is the biggest crisis. Robert Higgs, in his magnificent Crisis and Leviathan, he mentioned a couple of other types of crises that were also the health of the state. There's a so-called failure of capitalism, known as the Great Depression. Well, of course, you know, it wasn't really a failure of capitalism. Capitalism doesn't just break down, or free market capitalism doesn't just break down. You know, it's got a profit and loss feedback mechanism that's supposed to prevent that, if they're permitted to. Of course, as we saw what happened during the Great Depression, was that it wasn't completely permitted to do that. You had you know, government efforts to prevent wages from equilibrating. You had monetary policies that were preventing interest rates from equilibrating, and other kinds of causing uncertainty and all the rest. So indeed, you know, the market wasn't permitted to. The wars, you know, obviously a very big source of crisis. You know, there's a need to manufacture enemies, and indeed, government is usually quite good at doing this. You know, I guess I sort of, you know, held a lot of Cold War views up until the end of the Cold War, and then at the end of the Cold War, when you didn't have the communists anymore, you know, we still, you know, the declines in defense spending were very small, and it seemed like we were acting as if, you know, nothing had really changed. You know, it was like if the communists didn't exist, we would have had to invent them. And indeed, a government's been very successful at doing that. And an article that I saw not that long ago in Atlantic magazine cites two polls. First poll was taken in 1985. When they asked Americans how many of them view the Soviet Union as a serious threat, and you know, the top two box score, that they saw it as a very or moderately serious threat, 76% said yes, very or moderately serious, and 32% it gave it a top box score, so it was very serious. Okay, Soviet Union, 1985, something like 39,000 nuclear tipped missiles aimed at us and many other countries in the world. Well, this October, CNN had a poll asking Americans the same question, only this time it was about Iran. Well, Americans today, 81% of them said Iran was a very or moderately serious threat, and 48% said it was a very serious threat. Okay, that's Iran, right? A country with not a big industrial base. It doesn't have a single atomic bomb to its name. And, you know, again, it had its economy thrown into disarray by partly bad policy, even by partly, you know, the international sanctions leveled on. A 48% say that's a serious threat versus only 32% saying the communists in 1985 were a serious threat. So again, this is how you get public support with a lot of these kinds of policies. And then you've got, you know, financial crisis, which also, you know, certainly was a financial crisis and a lot of markets had problems. But, you know, they made it seem like that financial crisis, it was, you know, like the financial system was just about a dollar away from totally collapsing. And again, you know, much big exaggeration. So those things in mind, here is a chart that's just showing the U.S. federal debt as a percent of gross domestic product. Okay, and you could certainly want, you know, one piece of evidence that crisis is the health of the state. You just look at you know, where you get the big increase. Right? You get it during the Civil War, okay, a war crisis. World War One, another war crisis, the Great Depression, you know, the non-war crisis that I mentioned, World War Two, and then the financial crisis of 2008. Okay, so very clearly, your crisis gives the government the ability to grow and to grow through deficit spending. And if you go back, just you know, look over this entire period. You start out with the Revolutionary, well, you start with the Constitution, 1787. And of course, one of the things that the new central government did was they decided it would pick up the debts of the individual colonies and states prior to the ratification of the Constitution. But that's why you start out with about a 30% GDP amount of U.S. federal debt. But what did the government do? It actually, in those days, where you know fiscal orthodoxy was adhered to, where you know the ideas that you know that government was best which governs least were taken seriously, you actually had them systematically paying down it. Now again, some of this decline is actually paying it down. You know, the rest is coming from economic growth, right? Because this is a percentage of GDP. So if the GDP in the denominator gets higher, then the total amount's going to get lower. So this goes down pretty steadily. Then you got a little blip, a bump in the opposite direction that coincides with the War of 1812. You know, a somewhat smaller war, so a somewhat smaller addition to our deficit. And then again, it goes down again. And actually, by the Andrew Jackson administration, basically it eliminated the U.S. federal debt. Okay? And even when you had some panic of 1839, which today would certainly bring about all kinds of bailouts and stimulus packages, you know, hardly a thing happens there. Again, government didn't see that as its job, didn't have any idea it even could do something about it if it wanted. So then you got the Mexican War, and that was it was also a pretty small thing, so no, you know, very minuscule bump up there, just a couple of percent of debt as a percentage of GDP. Then the Civil War, again, that brings it back up to where it was, the ratification of the Constitution. The war ends. Then you pay it back, the economy improves, and basically right up to late 1800s, where you got the Spanish-American War, and again, another relatively small increase in debt. That goes down again until 1917, when we get involved in World War One. Then you got a big increase. Again, drop there, a little increase there. I guess here you had GDP go down when you had the 1920-21 depression, and then again, paying it back down during the 20s. Again, stock market crashes, income drops by about a quarter over three or four-year period. Deficits do come out as tax revenue go down. So again, builds back up. You didn't really get much prosperity back. World War II, though, at least nominal GDP goes way up. Your tax rates are increased, but not increased enough, and you get a big increase there in the debt as a percentage of gross domestic product, the highest level in our history to date. Although I don't think that statement is going to be true for very much longer. So after World War II, again, got big drops. Again, even the Korean War, you could barely see that on it. You know, that was somewhat, well, again, that was the war, as we'll see, was not financed through debt financing, financed pretty much through taxation. And until we get, you know, this goes down, you know, to about 25-30% in the mid-60s, and then again, President Johnson's guns and butter policies, you start to make it go up. The Reagan years, where, again, we've got big tax cuts and big military spending, which leads to big increases, again, some cuts at the end of the Cold War. And that, you know, the military budget went down, but not as much as you would think given the degree of which the threat it was supposed to defend us against went down. And then, of course, you know, the most recent financial crisis, as you have a recession, and as you have all kinds of stimulus policies to try to get us out of that recession, you are, you know, to the highest level, you know, that percentage of GDP has been since the Second World War. Okay, so this is really most of what's been going on. And in some ways, this chart actually understates, you know, the full situation, because, of course, you know, we've got debt, additional debt that's just built in to the future, right? You've got what are called the unfunded liabilities, you know, the Social Security payments that people have been promised, the Medicare payments that people have been promised. And those are far short of the taxes that are being collected you know, right now to fund them, and certainly they're far short of the taxes that are going to be collected in the future if the fund. Now, Lawrence Kotlikoff, who is an economics professor at Boston University, you know, has looked at this, and he's actually looked at some of the numbers, the Congressional Budget Office's own numbers. They've got something called an alternate fiscal scenario, which basically looks at, you know, if you don't change policies, you look at what's going to happen in the future if you continue, you know, to follow sort of the same policies that you're following today. And the number that the Congressional Budget Office comes up with was about $205 trillion. Okay, that's what we call the fiscal gap. That's how much, and I guess this is all discounted, you know, into the future, but taking into account future trend. The $205 trillion, that's something like 14 or 15 years of GDP. He says that it's 10% of all future GDP, again, if you sort of project things into the far future. And according to Kotlikoff's numbers, in order to close this fiscal gap, you either have to increase taxes by 57% or cut spending by 37%. Okay, right away, and then to keep it at those levels, you know, into the foreseeable future. So, again, we've certainly gotten to a point where government debts are playing a very big, you know, part of the economy. Just the interest on those debts, you know, is going to crowd out a lot of the other spending the government may want to do in the future. All right. So that's, again, sort of a broad picture background, you know, of what's been going on. Now I want to get to, I'm spending, I guess, most of the time really talking about military spending and the cronyism that results from that. So World War II is really the best place to start. It's a really a big breakpoint. But there's a lot of things that didn't happen in World War One. I just want to talk about briefly. In a sense, World War One was a dress rehearsal. It was sort of a dress rehearsal for the military-industrial complex that we've got today. It also was sort of a dress rehearsal for the New Deal. Okay, Bob Higgs in Crisis and Leviathan, you know, talks about World War One. He sees it sort of as the new normal. And the two quotes I want to take from Crisis and Leviathan. First thing that Higgs says is the great scale on which business had been mobilized and brought into contact with powerful but often congenial government officials awakened many businessmen to the lucrative possibilities of working more closely with government than they had thought possible or desirable before the war. So, you know, there's a change in ideology, which, you know, is a big part of what Higgs sees in Crisis and Leviathan. You know, you just get used to, you know, what you see, And, you know, the ideological, scruples, the fact, well, you can't do that. Well, we've been doing it for the last so many years, so yeah, we're going to keep doing it. The other thing that he says is that from the war can be dated the origins of the modern practice of massive informal collusion between government and organized private enterprise. And again, that's another good sort of short definition of crony capitalism. So that's World War One. That's sort of setting the stage. Okay, the dress rehearsal. Now you get the full-fledged, warfare state. It's showtime at the, it was World War Two, goes on and eventually the United States draws itself into it. And even though, like I said, World War One was a dress rehearsal, in a lot of ways things did go back to the way they were before. Not completely, Higgs's ratchet effect is still, in operation here. But before 1940, the United States had a relatively small standing army. It really didn't have a standing munitions industry, except during wartime. And what happened, I think, in World War One, a lot of the materials, they didn't have these big, defense contractors. They had companies that sold guns, and, government would buy guns from them. That's companies that sold uniforms. They had companies that sold boots. They had companies that sold, food that, canteens, whatever kinds of equipment military, personnel had to use. And they bought it from them. It was a one-time deal. They would, shop around and buy it, and they would, they would have the troops provisioned. Okay? And in that kind of situation, where, outside of wartime, that particular source of business just dries up, businessmen had little to gain from trying to wine and dine a congressman or War Department officials. Okay, but after that, things become very different. And one reason they became different was because of the policies that Franklin Roosevelt had taken before our entry into World War II. Right? One of the things about the New Deal, was to help the little guy at the expense of big business. The big businessmen of the day, the executives. Roosevelt, didn't miss very many opportunities to condemn them as economic royalists, as crypto fascists. They were the ones that were responsible for the Depression and for all the other problems that we had. Well, all of a sudden, by 1941 comes along, and even a little bit before 1941, really, we're getting, starting to gear up. Again, Roosevelt always had in his mind he wanted to get involved in this war. We had Lend-Lease, and we had other things. So, again, he didn't need a lot of output by military industries in the United States. So all of a sudden, Roosevelt needed these very people that he'd been excoriating for the previous 8 years. Okay? These are the people, if you wanted to win the war, forget about ideology, forget about class warfare. Who knows how to produce, who knows how to deliver the goods? Better than people that are running successful businesses. So of course, Roosevelt realized that, he needed them, and therefore, after 8 years of lambasting them, now he goes and says, I guess I better be nice to these guys. And he was probably a little bit too nice, for the good of the economy in the very long run. And Elbert and Smith, who was the official historian of the mobilization of the U.S. Army in World War II, actually makes the following statement about the new situation. Under the new conditions, contracts ceased to be completely binding. Fixed prices and contracts often became only tentative and provisional prices. Excessive profits received by contractors were recoverable by the government, and potential losses resulting in many causes, including errors, poor judgments, and performance failures on the part of contractors, were averted by modification and amendment of contracts, with or without legal consideration, were never required by the exigencies of war. So basically, now instead of saying these people are villains, give them whatever they want so that they will get the job done. They make it much easier to them, than it should have been. They get risk-free contracts, cost-plus contracts. So whatever it costs them, if they run over budget, no problem. Indeed, opposite of a problem. Their net gain gets increased accordingly. Okay, of course, you know, it's not really risk-free. There's still risks involved, but the risks all get shifted to the taxpayers. Okay, not only this, they got huge loans for expansion of their plant. And they were promised that after the war, we're not going to, you know, make you sit there, with all this excess capacity that we can't use, but we will, if necessary, buy these facilities, or you can buy these facilities from us, bargain prices, at the end of the war. So, again, they were given, a great deal of leeway there. So now, the government was bending over backwards to make things easy for them. All right, so that's, where you get a lot of cronyism, comes in, with those kinds of provisioning situations. And now also, of course, the warfare state, it was really gearing up. Federal taxes to finance the war increased by about three times, from 8% of GDP to 24% of GDP. And even at those, unprecedented rates, your taxes were only financing something like 50% of the war effort. Yeah, Henry Morgenthau realized that, and he wanted to make sure that whatever bond couldn't be sold, and war bonds actually financed about 30% of World War II. So 50% was financed by taxes, 30% by war bonds. The rest then, you had to bring the Fed in, the lender of last resort, to monetize the debt. And Morgenthau made sure it did that by decreeing that the Federal Reserve System, the so-called independent Federal Reserve System, they, under the decree of the Treasury Department, they had to peg U.S. bond rates. They had to peg U.S. bond rates at 2.5%. That's the Treasury bond. So what that means is, if the market wasn't, the market was going to force the price of trade, or not the price, the return on Treasury bonds above 2.5%, meaning that the market was making the price of the Treasury bond too low, the Fed would have to come in and buy up those bonds and boost their price to maintain the 2.5% rate of return upon it. Okay, and of course, this was a big boon for the banks. Okay, this was a gift to the banks, who were able to borrow at the discount window for 1%, and then turn around and spend the money raised at 1% to buy these treasury bonds that had a yield of 2.5%. So the Fed quickly learned to guarantee the banks easy money by rigging the yield curve for them. Okay, going back, so that's how the money was raised, and going back to how the money was spent. Well, again, you had a lot of contracts. And, of course, here you had some very big contracts. There, in 1942, there were $100 million worth of war contracts with the U.S. Department of War, as it was called at that time. GM got 10% of that. Okay, the top 33 firms got something like 50% of all those defense contracts, and the top 100 firms got 67%. But again, you've got a small group of people, getting in pretty close, pretty tight with the government. And again, while it's very likely General Motors, they were, at that time the biggest auto producer in the United States, biggest vehicle producer in the United States, it stands to reason, right, who's going to be better than them to produce military vehicles, whether it be jeeps, whether it be tanks, whatever. But still, the point is not so much that if they were going to have a war, they should use GM to help them provide the material for it, but rather, in working this closely with the government, it could do little but corrupt all these companies. And not that they were necessarily interested to start with, but they, again, for a while they weren't used to it, but they became very used to it and have not, never gotten unused to it. Okay, so that's the point. And then plus, like I say, the details of all these contracts, where again, you've eliminated, the possibility of loss, which is one of the things that I use as sort of a prime factor of crony capitalism. It's just a profit system, but not a profit and loss system. And one other thing about World War II was that, the Keynesian economists used this as well. So this proves that Keynesianism works. We don't get out of the depression until we've got the massive increase in aggregate demand caused by the war. Well, interestingly enough, you can also make the point, and I think make a better point, you were looking at some of the data, that it wasn't that we spent our way out of the depression. You know, again, one of those things too that happened, you know, a lot of people were put back to work once the war effort started. Why? Because there was a military draft. And you look at the numbers, the number of men drafted into the armed services was pretty similar to the number that were on unemployment line before we got involved heavily into that war effort. So right there, you get rid of the unemployment, but again, you're not producing goods and services that are making people's standard of living any better. And also, you know, what's happening here is that as much as the government debt as a portion of GDP went up from something like 40% in 1938 to about 110% in 1945, you've got a high household saving rate, something like 17% during the later years of the war. You've got household debt falling from about 60% of GDP in 1938 to 20% of GDP in 1945. You've got corporate debt falling by about 90% of GDP in 1938 to about 40% in 1945. So that's a 70% rate, you know, almost equaling the increase in government debt. You know, indeed, this sort of looks like the new classical school Ricardian equivalent. Yeah, you got all this deficit spending, but you've got people saving because they're going to be paying taxes with it in the future. Now, I'm not quite sure that the new classical view holds up. I don't think that the people are that far-sighted, and I don't think they were quite saving because they were saying, "Well, yeah, we got to pay our taxes after the war is over." I mean, they were saving for a number of reasons. One reason is that indeed a lot of these bonds were sold, to them, buy bonds, to finance the war effort, and also because there wasn't all that much to buy. I mean, there was a lot of, there were price controls, and with price controls usually come rationing. You had a lot of, staple goods, gasoline, sugar, meat, tires. They were all rationed, so there wasn't nearly as much to buy with their money. So indeed, I think people behaved, the way the new classicals would have it, but for very different reasons. And the point was, even all this war, production didn't necessarily increase aggregate demand by that much in the way Keynes would have said. But there were savings, and then after the war, those savings could be put to the civilian uses and help fund the recovery. So that's sort of World War II and the history of fiscal policy and cronyism during that point in time. From there, you move to the Korean War. Okay, and the Korean War was really almost a rare exception in the annals of warfare. This is one of the few wars of any magnitude that was financed almost exclusively with taxes. Okay, Truman increased taxes in September 1950 and again in January of 1951. During the 3 years when most of the warfare occurred, U.S. federal government outlays almost equaled a federal expenditure. It may have been a deficit of $100 million, which was truly a rounding error at that point in time. One of the things, and what Stockman actually says in praising Truman for his war finance, he says no elective war was ever financed with such purposeful discipline. And I imagine most wars, if you actually were in a war where you were invaded, I don't think there was too much financial discipline in running those either. And I think the war taxes really had the desirable effect of making the war unpopular. Okay, people could really see, besides those that had their sons drafted and sent to to fight and die, even those that didn't have that kind of skin in the game, they had. They felt it in their paycheck every week, or however often they were paid. One of the unfortunate things about this, however, was that the War Party learned a lot more from it than the anti-war party did. So the anti-war party never insisted that later wars were financed honestly through taxation, but the War Party made sure that they were financed dishonestly through borrowing and through inflation. And we've seen that in all the wars since Korea. Now again, Stockton, for all the praise that he did to Truman for his fiscal policy, did not have anything very good to say about his monetary policy. Basically Truman, he called it as naive about monetary policy as he was realistic about fiscal policy. But anyway, what Truman did, and even though he actually didn't have to do this because he did, finance it through taxation, he wanted to make sure that the Fed was there in case he did actually do it. These things got out of hand and the government required to spend a lot more than they could put on the backs of the taxpayers. He wanted the Fed to maintain that peg that they had on the interest rate of the long-term treasury bond. He wanted them to maintain that. And he actually went, and he wanted to make sure they would do this, and he met with the Federal Open Market Committee, and they met, and basically they discussed all these things, and really the Fed sort of resisted. They didn't want to do what he wanted to do. They hadn't yet had the accord where they actually stopped the peg, but that they definitely wanted to move in that direction. They didn't want to peg these interest rates anymore and just monetize all the federal debt. Truman leaves that meeting, and he goes and issues a press release, and he thanks the Fed for agreeing to maintain the peg, to maintain these low interest rates. Well, Mariner Eccles, who was the chairman of the Board of Governors of the Fed at that time, you got his assistant, William McChesney Martin, who was the successor as the head of the Fed, and they leaked the minutes of the meeting, and in the minutes, of course, there was no such promise by Eccles and the other directors, other governors, to continue the peg. So Truman was sort of caught with egg on his face there. All right. So you got Truman still in the Korean War. There's an election in 1952. Eisenhower wins it largely on his promise to bring the troops home from Korea. So indeed, that was what he did. Stockman refers to Eisenhower as a military hero who hated war, and he certainly knew enough about it to be pretty smart about it. And hated war, but when he had to do it, he seemed to do it the right way. He seemed, at least from the way Stockman depicts him, to be one of those rare generals who's not planning for the last war. He realized that the nature of the world had changed, and if he wanted to have a sound defense, he had to do it in a very different way than what he had done previously. Now, in the Eisenhower administration, one of the things that he did was he avoided any outright war. I mean, we had a Cold War during that whole time, but we didn't have outright war. Now, I forget who it was that said that war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means, maybe Talleyrand or the French diplomats. But now, of course, another way of achieving the ends you achieved through wars was through the CIA and its covert act, and we certainly did that in Iran and Guatemala, where we overthrew elected governments and installed our own puppets in there. So, that, while a lot of things you could say that are wrong with it, relatively cheap, didn't require a lot of deficit spending. Of course, CIA, nobody knows where their money was coming from. They had a lot of secret accounts. But still, not things that are forcing us to run up bigger and bigger debt. Okay, under Eisenhower, the budget actually shrunk, the military budget, shrunk quite a bit in real terms. I got some data here. Okay, so the yellow of the Eisenhower years, this is the defense budget, and this is, of course, I've divided it by the GDP deflator, so we put it into real terms. And in real terms, you go from almost a half a trillion dollars in at the end of Truman's administration, the full burden of the Korean War on budget, and you go down within really 3 years. He's cut the budget by about a third, the military budget, and it sort of stayed at those levels. This is what what Stockman refers to as the Eisenhower minimum. And even the total budget, using the same GDP deflator here, it only shows a slight increase, maybe a 5% increase over an eight-year, two-term administration. We have certainly not seen any president since letting the government budget grow at only 5% over an eight-year term. Most of them are lucky if they let it grow as little as 5% in a single year. Okay, so he gets his bloated war budget from Truman. And in fact, Truman had planned a 6% increase in defense over the, in his last budget. Like I said, Eisenhower had the 30% cuts planned, and he basically made good on it. Another thing that Eisenhower did was he really changed the priority of the military. You know, the way to fight wars, he didn't think there were going to be any more land wars. We had gone into the nuclear age, you know, for better or for worse, you know, pretty probably for worse. So what he needed was to protect against the Soviet and later the Chinese nuclear threats. Okay, he wanted a smaller army, but greater nuclear deterrence. Okay, and also he wanted to have a greater European role in the policy of containment of the Soviet Union. So military personnel, he went down from 3.5 million to 2.5 million during his administration. Okay, the emphasis on being able to confide a conventional war on land was something that he moved away from. And in fact, he had several of his generals who were sort of wedded to this old idea of conventional large-scale land warfare. Matthew Ridgway and Maxwell Taylor, they actually quit, although they later, Kennedy was elected, his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, he brought them back in. You know, they went back and they were sort of rehabilitated by it. Okay, so again, big increases. And again, okay, so I'm coming back to this this chart that I've got, this Excel spreadsheet. We're just looking at the real defense budget under Eisenhower. Okay, this is, adjusted using the gross domestic product deflator. So we went from about almost $500 billion in Truman's last year. And within about 3 years, Eisenhower got this down by almost 30%, $255.5 billion. Then it stays in that ballpark for the rest of his administration. And it doesn't really start going up until Kennedy. And then, of course, under Johnson goes up a lot more than that. And then over here, these are the numbers I calculated just for the total federal government expenditures. And basically, it went down, of course, when the military spending was falling rapidly, almost equally rapidly, and then later on it went up a little bit. But again, really one of the things about Eisenhower was not only did he cut military spending, but he really didn't come up with new programs to use up that peace dividend. He didn't have any new, he did have the Federal Highway Program, right? Again, probably there were a few roads to nowhere on that, but by and large, there was much more benefit from that than probably from most government spending programs that they got. But he didn't have anything like a great society or a new frontier or any of that. He wasn't expanding the welfare state to use up the funds that were now freed by the war effort. So, from the beginning to the end of his administration, we got maybe a 5% increase in the total federal budget. And as I was saying, we had you're lucky to find a president nowadays who got a 5% annual increase in the federal budget. That's 5% over an eight-year, two-term administration. Okay, so we had that going on. And then the other thing, too, was Eisenhower's Secretary of the Treasury was George Humphrey. And Humphrey, Humphrey made the comment that Stockman quote. He says high taxes were a greater menace than communism. Well, I'm surprised McCarthy didn't go after him for saying that in the middle of the Cold War. But anyway, he did say that. And even as much as he didn't like high taxes, he felt like, you're not going to get low taxes, though, until we've got spending down first. You know, we have to pay for what we consume. You know, and of course, I sort of have a problem with the use of we in that context. You know, that, you know, our government is certainly not we. You know, we are not the government's very different people. You know, as much as Austrians, you know, always talk about one of the problems with Keynesians and even non-Keynesian mainstream economists, you know, there's too much aggregation. You know, too much aggregation in concepts, you know, aggregate demand, aggregate supply, all that. You know, too much aggregation when you look at the numbers. Again, one of the things that I liked about Stockman was in a lot of cases, he really breaks things down. You know, he spent a lot of time looking at balance sheets and sort of he breaks things down. Says, oh, wait a minute, you know, AIG, this isn't all AIG that, you know, that's risking going under. It's the AIG financial, you know, part. And that makes a big difference in what the appropriate response was to it. Well, there's also verbal aggregation. And I think that word we, you know, can be a very dangerous word in there. You know, we, you know, the taxpayers probably, you know, we're paying for stuff we maybe didn't exactly want. So you have to make that seem like it's the right thing to do. It sort of reminds me of the Keynesian view of deficit. Well, deficits and government debt's not a big deal. We owe it to ourselves. Well, you know, we and ourselves are by no means the same people. And you know, I think Stockman, of course, does have that mindset throughout that, you know, better to, you know, to have a, you know, balanced budget, you know, even perhaps at a somewhat higher level, than to have a lower budget that's unbalanced. You know, the, you know, really the what the government is taking out of the economy is what it spends. And you know, whether that's financed by taxation, by inflation, by borrowing, you know, it's a problem. You know, taxation probably is the least the bad way of financing it because it is sort of honest. People realize, you know, what's being done, you know, what they're paying for, and give them a little bit more of an incentive, you know, to make sure the government doesn't, you know, buy things they don't want to pay for. But, you know, still that is a little bit of a problem. But nevertheless, you know, the federal budget was in fairly good shape under Eisenhower. And here, again, just to again put these numbers in context, you know, sort of one of the things that I fault Stockman for doing, for not having enough of the data, you know, there in the book. But here you go. Here's the Eisenhower administration, and you see how flat and how intertwined receipts and outlays are, and we see the drop in military spending during the first two years of his administration. So pretty much, you know, what I described. Then you've got the Johnson administration. Here's guns and butter. We see a big increase in defense spending during the United administration. We see, a little bit harder to see, but you can see that the outlays are growing even faster than just the defense outlays are growing, okay, indicating you've got a, you know, these great society welfare state programs going along with the Vietnam warfare state program. And again, you actually had that Kennedy tax cut that, you know, finally, you know, kicks in, you know, later in Johnson's administration. Well, he was even convinced that in the last year of his administration, 1968, to put a 10% tax surcharge on, which would, you know, pay for some of Vietnam War. Of course, you know, that certainly wasn't the only reason Vietnam became much less popular in 1968, but that certainly had a little bit to do with it. He actually, you know, gave us the last balanced budget that we had in the Clinton administration. Okay, so that's Johnson. So, again, big increase in war. And Nixon, who certainly we've seen has done a lot of bad things to the economy during his time in office. You know, he was actually still, you know, I guess had some vestigial Republican feelings for balanced budgets because he actually spent a lot of time, you know, trying to fight with Congress, trying to get the government spending cut. Now, again, he certainly had a lot of new initiatives. You know, he had the government spending more money. OSHA was set up under his administration. The Environmental Protection Agency was set up under his administration. So, I mean, he certainly was not a skinflint with taxpayers' money, but still, he was in some ways fighting. And you see, too, under his administration, you know, he wound down, you know, the Vietnam War. You know, you can argue whether he did it too slowly, you know, since indeed you know, the end result was what it might have been if they weren't there, you know, the North Vietnamese took over, you know, all of Vietnam anyway. But anyway, he did wind down the war, so they were actually cut from the defense budget under Nixon. But again, they were pretty much replaced by welfare state spending, whether it was his own initiatives or whether some of Johnson's spending was sort of kicking in. You know, Medicare, I would start, you know, the outlays were pretty small, but every year they get bigger and bigger, and that included under Nixon's administration. Okay, then, and oh, the other thing with Nixon, too, was, as I say, he was fighting with Congress over spending. And a thing that presidents had done, you know, they were considered to have the constitutional power to do it, and he had done it ever since Jefferson. And also 43 governors of 43 states, he had the same power. This was the power of impounding. They didn't necessarily have to spend every dollar that the legislature appropriated. And this is what Nixon was trying to do. He was trying to restrict those expenditures. And in so doing, he got into a fight with Congress. And Congress finally passed the 1974 Impoundment Control Act. And that basically made it almost impossible for presidents to refuse to spend money that had been appropriated by the Congress. And that was something I'm surprised Stockman didn't mention it. He did, it was in passing, and I don't remember it. But indeed, at that point, you know, you had a big, you know, increase in the slope of the curve of government output. Now, again, it wasn't the only thing, obviously. You know, just 3 years prior, we had the breakdown of Bretton Woods, the breakdown of monetary discipline. So by all means, you would expect that, you know, certainly played a big role. But it seemed like that the, you know, Impoundment Control Act of 74 couldn't have helped very much. Then you've got Reagan. And again, Reagan was one that, again, Stockman worked for him. I guess he believed in what he had said to a large extent. And wanted to cut him as much slack, you know, as he could. And, you know, Reagan, obviously, big increases in spending, mostly for defense. He did, you know, as much as he talked a much better game than he played as far as cutting domestic spend. But he did cut a little. Now, again, it turned out to be a drop in the bucket. There was roughly a 10% reduction in real non-defense discretionary spending during Reagan's first term. Now, of course, the thing you got to remember is that real non-defense discretionary spending is a fairly small portion of the budget. So 10% of that, you know, probably maybe a couple of percent of the total domestic spending. I mean, you've got these entitlements, which are getting bigger and bigger as a portion over time. So it's not that big part of a budget. But he did make efforts. You know, indeed, this is one of the reasons Stockman, wanted to work in that administration. But those cuts weren't nearly enough to offset the defense spending increases that he put into place. See, the tax cuts that Reagan had. Now, again, it was shaped to a large extent by the supply side advisors that he surrounded himself with. But there were also other things. You know, there was a lot of agreement, even by non-supply side economists, that the taxes would do to be cut. You know, partly because there had been a lot of inflation, you know, starting in the mid-60s and continuing and really picking up steam through the Carter administration. And what did that inflation do? At a time where there were about a dozen tax brackets in the personal income tax schedule, this was pushing people into much higher and higher tax brackets. You know, as there was inflation, then wages caught up, and all of a sudden people were in higher tax brackets. You know, middle-class people maybe were not expected to be in the high tax brackets in which they were finding themselves. So if part of the tax cuts were just really to undo the bracket creep that had occurred. But the other thing is, a supply-side advisor is telling Reagan, well, you've got to cut taxes. Well, what does supply-side economics say? It says basically that marginal tax rates have important impacts on incentives. Okay, if marginal tax rates are too high, people are going to put their money, people that are wealthy are going to put all their money in tax shelters where they don't pay taxes on it. You know, people that are less wealthy, you know, that have to work, but they have a choice. You know, if I'm a teacher, should I teach this extra class in summer school. You know, if I'm in a 70% bracket, it may not be worth it. Okay, whereas if I'm in a 30% bracket, it probably is worth it. You know, if you've got a choice about taking overtime or not, you take it out. You know, those marginal tax rates are going to have some impact. All right, that's the whole idea behind supply side economics. Again, you know, unless the rate is extremely high, you know, those tax cuts aren't going to pay for themselves. If you bring them down from 90% to 60%, they might. If you bring them down from 35% to 25%, they're probably not going to. So, you know, except for Arthur Laffer and a few real diehards, most supply side economists, you realize that elasticities were such that we weren't going to have an increase in tax revenue. But you did have, you know, people were in those high brackets, you know, where their rates were going down from 70% to 50%. There may have been, you know, either an increase or a much smaller decrease in tax revenue. And a lot of work has been done. You're looking at what portion of tax revenue was borne, you know, by the top 1% or the top 5%. And there you see that their portion was right, indicating that indeed, you know, there were incentive effects, even if they weren't big enough to raise taxes. And as you see, when the Reagan cuts went in, you know, the tax revenue did fall quite a bit those first couple of years. And then after that, there were tax increases to try to offset some of those. But the point is, the marginal tax rates is the way you bring about those incentives. Well, it turns out, you know, the number of stocking bids is about 50%. Only about 50% of the tax cuts in Reagan's 1981 Economic Recovery Act were in the marginal tax rates. The other 50% were a lot of special provisions for business lobbies. He had tax credits for wood-burning stoves. That went over very well in New England and maybe Alaska, but, you know, not so good in Alabama or Georgia. You had 10-year write-offs for commercial buildings, and these commercial buildings were expected to last 50 years or more. So again, that's a big reduction in taxes that's not, you know, connected to the marginal tax rate. You've got tax credits of $2,500 for owners of oil or royalty. Okay, this is just a few of these things. And again, in Stockman's reckoning, you know, they're about half of the taxes. Okay, those, you know, have a much lower impact on giving incentives to do the kind of things that, you know, are going to help economic growth. I mean, they're going to obviously greatly increase incentives to have wood-burning stoves and to, you know, to build new buildings. But again, it may very well result in overbuild rather than in the right level of building. Okay, so this is what you've got going on, you know, in those Reagan years. And not just the domestic, and then you've got Clinton, where he raised taxes, you know, government spending grew more slowly, actually a decline in defense spending. And you got Bush, whose tax cuts, again, put us back into deficit, you know, that in combination with the spending increases, you know, all of his defense spending, the domestic spending, no child left behind, Medicare prescription drug benefit, and then, you know, in the last year of his administration, the bailouts, so that's really the history of fiscal policy since 1940. Okay, let me go back to Reagan's defense policy. And you don't mind if I use the 5 extra minutes that we spent repeating when my stuff wasn't on the WebEx to just finish up? Well, I will take that as a bit. Yeah, okay, that's fine. Let me just talk about that a little bit more. So you've got Caspar Weinberg, the Captain Knife, who was Reagan's defense secretary. And if you got that name, Captain Knife, because he had served in the last years of the Nixon administration and during most of the Ford administration as the director of the Office of Management and Budget. And in that job, he was supposed to cut spending, so he did pretty much, you know, at least try to help Nixon to get his spending cuts through. So he was called Captain Knife because of that. But otherwise, he was nothing but a knife. He was a lifelong bureaucrat. He headed many of the departments of the, you know, U.S. government. executive branch. And Stockman refers to him as a relentless solicitor for any branch of the state he currently headed. And Reagan trusted him implicitly. But you know, he really didn't repay that trust. You know, when Reagan, you know, after the big deficit in 1981, you know, signed a tax increase, again, he signed that increase on the condition that there would be $3 of spending cuts for every $1 of tax increase. Well, you know, Republicans, you know, had to compromise, had to, you know, have to cut some defense spending in order to get the Democrats to cut some welfare spending. And Weingarten just refused to accept any Republican promises on that. And when, a couple of years later, you know, the Republicans in Congress recoiled, you know, at the thought of $200 billion deficits as far as the eye could see. And he tried to get cuts again. Again, Weinberger insisted that any attempt to cap the defense growth at only 5% a year was a grave threat to national security. But again, he seemed to see no options. He seemed to see no trade-offs in the budget. You know, it's either that he didn't realize that a strong economy was just as vital to national defense as the right weapons, or he was simply a military king. And that was one of the things that Eisenhower, you know, to his credit, thought. Eisenhower was no military king. He was no Keynesian of any kind. He realized that the defense budget was a cost. You know, if you had threats, you know, obviously you're much better off not having those threats fulfilled than having them, you know, by being too weak, it could lead to war. But he realized it was a cost. He realized it was taking away from the standard of living, you know, in the rest of the economy. It seemed like that was not the case with Weinberg. And as a result, you know, what the Reagan defense budget really was, it was a blank check to the Department of Defense and the defense contractors and everybody else. You know, the last Carter budget, at least the last expenditure under Carter, was about $142 billion for a defense spending. By 1986, that went up to $370 billion. In the Reagan budget, that's from 140 to 730, that's a $230 billion blank check. Okay, the neoconservatives in the late 70s convinced Reagan and many others that the Soviet Union was on the verge of acquiring nuclear war-winning capabilities, first strike capabilities. They could level a first strike against us that was so devastating that we wouldn't be able to respond in kind. Now, again, the newly opened archives, you know, when the Iron Curtain fell and the Soviet Union and Communist Party went out of power, okay, documents there show that threat wasn't real. The Soviet Union was raising its defense spending by about a 1 percentage point per year. You know, they didn't really have any plans to try to be able to win a nuclear war against us at that time. And so in the first case, the threat wasn't real. In the second case, the nature of the threat, if they were going to apply first strike capability, would require a certain type of spending. You're making sure that your ability to strike first isn't compromised. You know, that your land-based stationary missiles, that perhaps you harden the silo sites. You know, you have more of them, so it's more difficult to find all of them. You even have some of those missiles actually make them mobile. And we have the MX missile that is what that was. These trains or trucks were transporting them all over the country like a shell game. They wouldn't know, the enemy wouldn't know where they were. We had the submarine leg of our nuclear triad. You know, you had submarines, so they're mobile, and again, they're moving around, so again, Soviets can't, you know, find them and destroy them at a first strike. Well, these were not the kinds of weapons that we were buying with this $230 billion blank check. And indeed, the whole process, and talk about not wanting to see how the sausage was made, and it certainly turned Stockman against what he saw going on. But Reagan made a speech in 1980, September of 1980 in Chicago, promising 5% real growth in the defense budget. Well, it turns out Carter's outgoing defense budget called for 5% increase. So it's not very convincing to say that Carter's leaked on national defense when you're not planning to increase defense any more than you need. So they had to raise, they had to up the ante and raise the spending target to 7%. But one of the things that happened behind the scenes But that 7% was not based on Carter's 1980 budget of $142 billion. It was rather based on a much higher number. The defense committees of Congress had gone and looked at Carter's budget, and they increased the defense part of the budget to $180 billion. And then you had the lame duck defense department raise it to $205 billion. And then Senator John Power, Republican of Texas, who was one of the most hawkish members of the Congress, he added some supplemental appropriations that made it, that added $17 billion. So that also brings you up $222 billion. So you've got a 50% increase from Carter originally had, and you were making a 7% real increase. So that's, you know, nominal plus about 11% inflation you had that year on this $222 billion budget. By the time you got all the way up to 1986, that's where you reached $370 billion. So it's just sort of this back of the envelope calculation based on numbers, and there's no thought about what's going into those numbers. Well, that was to come later. And that was how those funds were, how the funds were to be allocated. And, Stockman expected, well, once you're working, if you did not need for an additional $230 billion, surely, they'll damp down the budget and not spend a lot. Well, as Stockman himself admits, chalk this one up to the wishful thinking department, maybe one of the record setters there. So anyway, rather than scale back once they actually took a cold, hard, sober look at what the needs were, they all got lined up like pigs at the trough to try to get their share of the spending. And indeed, the military couldn't really use it all fast enough, but they made sure to get the projects on the books so they wouldn't lose those that funding in future budgets. And indeed, so that was the Defense Department's view, of course, as good bureaucrats. They were empire builders. They wanted to get as much as they could. And the congressmen, of course, they saw this as just a gigantic jobs program for their own constituency, for their congressional district. And, it's interesting. The actual deterrent force that we had, the strategic bombers, the submarine-based missiles, the land-based missiles, they were in place, and they really needed very little additional spend. Indeed, Robert Higgs quotes Ernest Fitzgerald, who was the author of a book called The Pentagon. And Fitzgerald cites a Lockheed employee who, off the record, says to him, the government doesn't really need this stuff. It's just the best way to get rich quick. If they really needed all these nuclear bombs and solar satellites, they wouldn't run this place the way they do. And as this author, Fitzgerald, said to Robert Higgs, a defense contract is just a license to steal. And it certainly looks like that during these particular years. And you bought these weapons anyway. And again, so these were weapons to fight conventional land wars. And what happens? Well, they end up being used to enable the wars of choice. All the wars in the Persian Gulf, the Iraq wars, the war in Afghanistan. And then, later on, I just saw this in a local newspaper item a couple of weeks ago. They were given to help militarize our police. In the headline is Spoils of War, Police Getting Leftover Iraq Trucks for Free. The Defense Department has given away 18-ton armor-protected military fighting vehicles to law enforcement agencies under a national military surplus program. It's armored, it's heavy, it's intimidating, and it's free, says the Albany County Sheriff. So, again, do not give anybody power you don't want them to abuse. And you've seen that money is power. And you've seen what it's done to the Defense Department. So, okay, I guess I've more than used up our time. I hope that was enlightening. And Danny, why don't you open up the floor to questions?
I don't see any questions yet in the chat box or the Q&A box, so please feel free to post a question, everybody. Okay, so Bob Shaw asks, what was the cost of the space race?
You look at all the astronauts, and they're all, you know, the Air Force, or the Army, or the Marines, or the Navy, or what have you. So, and certainly if you're going to have a space-based weaponry, you've got to be able to put satellites up into space and keep them up in space. So I imagine some of the space race probably was in there, but I'm not familiar with the breakout.
While we're waiting for student questions, I have a question, Bob. Do you think it seems that even though Kennedy had, according to David Stockman, that Kennedy had a lot of Keynesian advisors that he invited into the White House, it didn't seem that he listened to them all that much, except the one thing that Stockman takes him to task for was a big tax cut, but in terms of monetary policy, it does seem that Chairman Martin pretty much adhered to the same policies that he had been doing under Eisenhower.
Right. It didn't sound like he was putting the kind of pressure on Martin that Johnson later put on. Yeah, I don't think too many people could put the kind of pressure on people that Johnson could put on people, but. Yeah, and trying to think, well, you know, there wasn't even, I think Stockman did talk a little bit about like Tobin and Heller saying, oh, you know, we've got this full employment or the potential GNP, and, you know, we're like 2% below potential GNP, so let's try to increase spending a little bit to try to stimulate the economy and get us up to that. You know, and Stockman saying, oh, look, what are you talking about, you know? For one thing, potential GNP, right? It's such a murky number. You don't really know what potential GNP is. I don't think any economist to this day has known exactly what the potential GNP is. I mean, you sort of take a guess, and I guess you know that if you stop it to generate overheating and inflation, you know you're past it. And I guess if you've got high unemployment, you know you're below it. But, you know, there's a lot of range as to what that GNP is. And, he, you know, he's saying, well, you know, these advisors are telling Penny, hey, let's try to push the, you know, the spending up a little bit to try to, and that's probably the biggest critique that I recall him making about Kennedy. And you know, and as far as the taxes, actually, you know, when Kennedy was in, the marginal tax rates, some of them were so high that they might have, you know, generated a little bit more revenue, at least from those groups of people who were paying them. I mean, the maximum tax rate when Kennedy came into office was 91%. That was the top marginal tax rate. Yeah, and his cut reducing them from 91 to 70. I have a hunch that among those people, he may have gotten a little bit more revenue. So they got, you know, further down the line, you're not going to get, you're going to get less revenue, but just you can't use static score. You do have to, you know, take into account that you will generate a little bit of a higher tax base.
So that might be a case where the Laffer curve actually did work.
Yeah, I think about, you know, I wrote an article again way back in the day when I was full time and I was actually getting some stuff published. It was about the Laffer curve, and I actually looked at just what likely elasticities are with labor supply and demand. And I also did, you know, it also included some meta analysis of a bunch of other studies that were done, and it seemed like the consensus was that. You know, the Laffer curve, the place where the Laffer curve turns back, is at about a 70% rate. So if you reduce it from 91 to 70, I would think you draw some things out of tax shelters and you are going to get some more revenue from those people. And like I said, you'll also, you know, the higher the rate is, you know, the bigger, you know, the incentive change is. And that's why you do get at least a redistribution, a little bit more tax revenue comes out of those at the higher echelons. When you lower the rates. Okay, the comment from Bob, Bob Short.
So Bob says, my father talked about the dumping of war material after World War II, and now we're giving it to the police. Interesting. Comment?
Yeah, well, yeah, I wonder how much war material we dumped was foreign aid that we sent it to some of our either allies or just, I don't know, somebody else to get rid of it. Yeah, and then I see the question up top from John.
How can conservatives take seriously GOP candidates, most of them in 2012, say that not one dime can be cut in military spending?
Yeah, well, no, I don't think you can take it very seriously. And I must admit, before the late 80s, I was sort of a Cold War warrior. I believe that, the communists were a real threat, and you had to make sure you kept them in check, and that they were much more imposing than they actually were. But once 1989, that was a lot of people's their epiphany. That was some of the writers, the late Joseph Sobran, who used to write for National Review, when he saw that the communists weren't a threat anymore, and yet we were still spending money like they were. That really sort of turned him around and led to his run-in with Buckley and getting kicked off of National Review. Lou Rocco always talked about when the Berlin Wall was falling, and you would see that George H.W. Bush and some of the other people in the administration, they were like, you would think something bad had happened. They were like so worried that they didn't have a reason for all this military spending. Of course, it didn't take them long to find new reasons. But, that I think, was an epiphany for a lot of people, that, if there weren't real communists, we would have had to invent them. I think that was, a real turning point. And, to say that we spend, I think our military spending is more than all the other countries in the world put together. Right? So you really need that. And again, as I think Stockman may have said this different places, not one of our potential enemies is an industrial power. Russia is a shadow of its former self. China may in the future become, if we provoke them. They may have to worry about in the future, but I think we've got a big cushion that before that's going to happen. But most of my relatives and friends are sort of on the Republican side. And I say, Republicans and Democrats, they're doing the same thing. It's just that they've got different cronies, that they're giving the money to. Democrats give more of it to labor, and Republicans give it to more to defense contractors. But, they both give it to corporations, at the banks and all the rest. But there's just a little bit of difference in who's getting the help. But the average person, it doesn't matter that much which of them is just whose friends are rewarded.
So Bob Shaw asks, what is your feeling about the domino effect of the Vietnam War?
The domino theory. Well, I guess in retrospect, it looks like it wasn't going to get past Laos and Cambodia. I mean, that was a big thing in the Kennedy administration. So you didn't really hear that much about Vietnam, but you heard a lot about Laos. There was sort of civil war there. And I remember that was, I read a book this past year, the James Douglas book about the Kennedy assassination. JFK assassination, why it mattered, or the unspeakable, the name of the book. And he goes a lot into how, Kennedy was already seen as very suspect because he wanted to have a coalition government. I mean, the way communists seemed to operate, I could sort of see, some concern with that. But again, Laos, I think, did not turn totally communist the way Cambodia, eventually did with the Khmer Rouge, who practiced, on a per capita basis, probably a worse genocide than Hitler and Mao did. But I don't think, I don't think that the communism was going to spread to Thailand. I mean, I think there are a lot of factors, about all former French Indochina, which is what those three countries were, Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. So I don't think, and indeed, look, we did lose the Vietnam War. The communists did march in and take over South Vietnam. And in fact, when they later marched into Cambodia, hard to believe that this could be the case, but the North Vietnamese communists were a big improvement over the Khmer Rouge. So they kicked out of Cambodia. And they didn't continue, they didn't go into Thailand and Myanmar or India or anything like that. So no, it looks like that was an excuse. And maybe a lot of people believed it. Again, I believed it at the time, but I got the excuse. I didn't know anything at that time. I was still in high school or just starting college. But it looks like that was not the big thing. And I was also reading a book about Mao. This is a book, I forget the author's name, but this was the real anti-Mao book and he was saying, I imagine he loved that the U.S. was in Vietnam. He wanted to try to just put enough pressure to keep draining away more and more American troops and American money. And that looked more like what was the case given what was going on than we actually had. Oh, John, so kindly mentions JFK and the Unspeakable. And he comments a great book, and I agree with that. It's very well documented, and really looks like he's got the goods on the people that did it. Okay, another question from John.
Shortly before that, Eric had a question.
Didn't see that one there.
Eric asked, the Soviet threat was a real threat, and certainly affected their threats by Reagan's military increases. Iran is a joke in comparison. Are people today so easily manipulated by the media and the government, or are there just too few sensible voices speaking?
I think they are very easily manipulated. I just said, right, Soviet Union was a big threat, and I even wonder, Stockman makes the case that objectively, this buildup, since we were building up in the wrong things that weren't even aimed at what the Soviet threat was, you would think that it shouldn't have, it didn't have that much real issue. But still, sometimes the perception is greater than the reality. And if the Soviets thought we were building up, and, Reagan spoke about the Star Wars program, and even if that was pie in the sky and was never going to work, if they thought it was, it could have, made them sort of throw in the towel. And that's possible. And I'm not, that well-versed in all of those issues. But I can sort of see why it might have at least been the last straw. As Stockman rightly states, following von Mises and most Austrian economists, the problem with the Soviet economy itself, the fact that communism just can't deliver the goods on that kind of a basis, so it was going to come down eventually anyway, and maybe this way, they finally, and yet somebody like Gorbachev, who wasn't as bloodthirsty as his predecessors, who wasn't willing to shoot down demonstrators in the streets in order to maintain absolute power. We've seen all those things going on. There are a lot of things. I think that buildup may have had a tiny impact, but clearly a lot of other things were at play. So I think people beat they beat the war drums enough, and people do worry about that and get scared about that. Although, it seems like right now, it seems like the majority of people were against the U.S. going into Syria. It seems like there are a lot of people that are sort of relieved that, we right now, at least have a breather, until we, decide to do something against Iran. Maybe people are changing. Maybe they, there are fewer, more people are hearing the truth. And again, there are enough more alternative outlets to the mainstream media that people can get that from. So and we'll see. We'll see if they, once it gets to the point where they do decide to make something happen, everything that went on before, is going to go down the memory hole. So I don't know. I'm slightly optimistic about that, but it certainly looks like again at that poll, which was taken pretty recently. I don't know if things were worse 6 months ago or a year ago, but it doesn't seem that good that people think that Iran, which, as you say, is a joke, it was considered a serious threat. 48% of the people, that's a pretty high number.
And John asks, did you get this one already? How intimately tied are the corporate crony media and the big different contractors and corporations?
Well, which station is GE on? Is that NBC?
Yeah.
He's got a big defense part of it, so I think that's a big, I guess Disney may not be so bad on that defense capitalism, but GE certainly. And who owns the third network? Who owns CBS?
Westinghouse?
Okay, well, I think they would probably have a lot of defense contracts. So, that may be a good point on which to end.
Oh, it's owned by Viacom.
Viacom? Okay. I'm not sure about that. The general electrical is definitely. All right, let's see. What do you think? Go ahead. Can I read it?
Okay, Bob asked, any thoughts about the Mandela phenomenon?
What is the Mandela phenomenon?
Yeah, about Nelson Mandela. And the response to his legacy.
Well, you know, I guess I remember thinking when he took over. I remember thinking to myself, well, there goes South Africa down the tube. And somehow he did manage to not turn it into a total mess. I also wonder, you know, I guess he was a member of the Communist Party. But I'm not sure how much he was, you know, really a communist, or that was the only party that was against apartheid in the time. But I read things, I think this was one of Walter Williams' books, The State Against Capitalism or something, and it was, he wrote a little bit about South Africa. And I thought that actually that the beginning of apartheid came from the left. I think this guy was Joe Slovo. I don't know if that was the name of the head of the South African labor unions, who actually, you know, they wanted to have apartheid to prevent black competition, you know, with the white, you know, Afrikaner workers. So, you know, it's fun. And in fact, if I have my facts correct, and I might not, but I think that you actually started apartheid in that way. You know, you get the free market here. W.H. Hutt wrote about the coal bar in Africa, and he was criticizing, you know, them. And it was at least the labor union left, if not farther to the left than that. So I don't know, if, you know, how communist Mandela really was, and that maybe I just don't know about this. But you know, he may have been, you know, again, he was a politician too, but all things considered, you're more of a force for good than most politicians are. Again, it seems like South Africa does continue to be a thriving nation. It hasn't gone down the tube like I feared when you know, that first happened. Okay, and then John's question about belligerent nationalism and humanitarian intervention.
Do you think the belligerent nationalism and humanitarian internationalism are the two sides of the war party can be broken as long as we have government schools?
You know, it seems to be the case. I mean, because sometimes that, you know, that the line between the belligerent nationalism and interventionism is the same. You know, it's a very fine line. I mean, look at Syria, right? We were saying we had to go into Syria for humanitarian reasons, right? I mean, I think you had both of those rationales being used to justify that same, you know, potential action. So yeah, I think that probably is the case. All right. Thank you, everybody. I'll see you next week.
Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome. Good night.